What about sanctimonious Cromwell and his Ironsides that put the women and children of Drogheda to the sword with the Bible text, God is love, pasted round the mouth of his cannon? James Joyce, Ulysses, 1922. Long ago, there lived a terrible bad man named Oliver Cromwell. At about the middle of the 16th century, he came to Ireland with a band of soldiers and adventurers. They committed great slaughter and other foul deeds. They also drove the farmers and peasants out of their homes to the poor lands of Connacht or a well-known place with a climate considerably hotter. This man Cromwell placed his soldiers and adventurers in large tracts of the best lands from where the Irish farmers were driven. These men were called landlords. These landlords, after some time, divided some of their estates into small farms and placed tenants on them, from whom they got huge rents. Collector Kathleen Gibney, address Bohermean, County Meath, informant Tommy Gibney. Oliver Cromwell. His name is celebrated as an important figure of parliamentary democracy in the United Kingdom. Cromwell dispatched a king, he was the first republican, and an advocate for democracy. In Ireland, however, his lasting effect is one of a genocidal tyrant. His consideration of the Irish people as inhuman was self-professed, and the inhumanity for which he inflicted arguably places him in a position of contempt higher than any royal. In Irish folklore, this contempt is plain to be seen. Cromwell is written as a personal friend or assistant of Satan, if not the devil incarnate. An Chogha a Críochna Éire, the war that finished Ireland. This is what a conquest of the country during the War of the Three Kingdoms was dubbed. An ethnic cleansing headed by one man. But this episode's purpose is not to daub Cromwell with fruitless emotional hatred. That'll get us nowhere. Instead, the aim is to look at the facts. The what, where and why of Cromwell's campaign, in quotation marks, of Ireland between 1949 and 1950. The short horror of only 9 months left a lasting effect, which saw the displacement of many native Irish, at best into Connacht or farther afield to Barbados, in the form of indentured servants. But these people were perhaps lucky. Many died. But while most of us know Cromwell to be, as it pertains to our history, an awful bad bastard altogether, many of us don't know exactly the why, and it is our duty for us to understand our history, particularly now in this present. We are learning in real time that truth is the first casualty of war, but it is the assault on truth and on reality which allows oppressors to bend the world to their whim in hindsight or even in present tense. This episode does not wish to dwell on the past, but to confirm what we know and consider it in terms of our present. Cromwell's campaign on Ireland was unjust, cruel, and a de facto attempt at genocide, displacement, and settler colonialism based purely on religion and ethnicity. Still, it is somehow debated whether or not Britain carried out an ethnic cleansing in Ireland. As if the truth of the situation was literally scorched from the earth with his coming here. And whilst many Irish accounts from the time are rightly subject to scrutiny on the grounds of hyperbole, emotion, religious spin, or a lack of concrete evidence, this does not take away from the facts. Faced with the prospect of an Irish alliance with Charles II, and hot on the memory of the Ulster Rebellion, which saw the murder of Protestant settlers in Ireland in an effort to reclaim stolen land, Cromwell carried out a series of massacres to subdue the Irish. Once he returned to England, the English commissionary, General Henry Ireton, Cromwell's son-in-law, adopted a deliberate policy of crop burning and starvation in the country. In 1641, when all was said and done, total excess debts for the entire period was estimated by Sir William Petty, the 17th century economist, to be 600,000 out of a total Irish population of 1,400,000 people. That's around 42% of the populace. 42% were murdered. A conscious ethnic cleansing occurred in Ireland. It was validated by religion and by the superpower of the time. Britain. This is not a fact to be debated as a matter of opinion. Critics of this fact often point to arbitrary laws in place at the time, which point to the inhumanity as fair, but fair only under the supposition of a people as near subhuman. Once again, this is an episode on the past, but I do not need to express why it is important in the present. The evidence we are using is not from nationalistic pundits from that time or now. The admission of ethnic cleansing comes straight from the horse's mouth, Cromwell's own words, taken from his own diary entries during the time of the bloody affair. Aside from this, our key resource which will underpin the episode will be the research of John Morrill, the professor of British and Irish history at Cambridge and the former head of the Cromwell Society in the UK. Even he has to admit there's a whiff of genocide and more than some physical warts on Cromwell and the Ironsides. The Irish can never forget it, and the English can never remember it. This is what writer and philosopher G.K. Chesterton had to say on Cromwell's conquest between 1649 and 1650. And all of this is not to discount that Cromwell was important to parliamentary politics in the UK. Just because someone was important and righteous in one regard does not mean he wasn't a tyrant in other regards. Virtues don't cancel out sins. Just as someone's face is clean, it doesn't mean that there ours isn't. And just for the crack as well, to keep the show functioning as it usually does, I'm going to sprinkle in some Dukas folk stories. This is a serious topic, but we're still trying to have some fun with it. These folk stories are funny and not to be taken as anything close to fact, and maybe just to give you the vibe of what Cromwell is perceived as on a colloquial level here in Ireland. So if I start talking about collectors and informants, that's likely a National Folklore Collection story. I'm pretty sure you'll know by the vibe of them. I'll just give you a taster one right now. Cromwell and a Crow. There is an old church not far from this school, and it is supposed that Cromwell plundered it. One day, Cromwell came to the church, and he left his soldiers outside and went into the church himself. He was a long time in the church, and the soldiers were wondering what was keeping him. A few of his soldiers crept to the door and looked in, and they saw Cromwell talking to a crow. Cromwell was very angry because the soldiers saw him, and he went outside and took his scarf from his neck and threw it round the necks of the soldiers and hanged them across his shoulder. Collector Francis Fay, address Clonmore, County Loud. So Cromwell, his characteristic, never went anywhere without his scarf, as you know, loved autumn, and he must have been gigantic. He hung a few soldiers across his neck. That's the sort of flavour. You'll know the difference. You'll know by the tone of my voice and the cut of my jib whether I'm being very, very serious or not. This is a serious thing. Cromwell's early life.
I was by birth a gentleman, living neither in considerable height nor yet in obscurity.
Sorry, is that Cromwell's voice? I know he's from the north of England. He's from the north. No, I'm joking. This is about Cromwell's time in Ireland, of course, but it's probably important to sum up the guy and what led him here. Born to a political family, Cromwell's father was of modest means, but still a member of the landed gentry. The family initially acquired great wealth as occasional beneficiaries due to the dissolution of the monasteries, and this was the dissolve of Catholic institutions by Henry VIII. Cromwell would join Parliament representing the area of Huntingdon, but became involved in disputes locally, sold most of his properties and moved to a farmstead nearby, which was a significant step down in society for the Cromwells. In 1631, it was said that Cromwell was treated seemingly for depression, perhaps as a result of this dispute, and religion seemed to be his saving grace. In a letter to his cousin, he gives an account of a spiritual awakening, describing himself as being the chief of sinners and how he was now among the congregation of the firstborn. He expressed belief that he was saved from his previous sins by God's mercy, that the Reformation hadn't gone far enough, and that much of England was still living in sin, and that Catholic beliefs and practices must be fully removed from the church. And now, not to get it twisted early on in this episode, I have no problems with Protestantism. I actually think the Reformation comes from a good place. It's mainly, you know, planting, as in, unfortunately, as with all things, religion kind of gets conflated into, Protestant planters that were put into Ireland, Protestant English planters, and the nodal religious thing, don't have a problem with. Don't particularly love Catholicism either. It's when either or, they just start bullying either way. It's the problems with religions. I mean, we want to give everyone freedom of religious choice, but oftentimes it seems that instead of, it's either like one is being the oppressor or the other one's being the oppressor. Which isn't very godly in my understanding and estimation of it. It's perhaps of note, as I was saying, that John Merrill was once the head of the Cromwell Society in the UK, and yet he himself cannot permit the ignorance surrounding the atrocities Cromwell spearheaded. He says, and I quote, "The depth of hatred that still exists in Ireland is matched only by unawareness in non-Catholic English circles of what Cromwell did in Ireland." So the demands of English viceroys led to violent rebellion. Rebellion led to the confiscation of rebel lands and the introduction of English, Scottish and planters, i.e. settlers. The early Stuart period saw a significant drop in violence, but not of injustice or resentment from the native Gael. In the 1630s, Charles I's Lord Deputy, the Lord Strafford, was sent to Ireland to make it less of a financial drain on England, and to sweeten the Irish up. To make things just a bit less unfair, he granted more religious freedom to the Catholics and raised their revenues by making the English settlers return some of their ill-gotten gains. As the tide in Britain turned against monarchy, Strafford was executed by the Parliament, leaving room for Protestant colonists to take their revenge. The Catholics faced renewed persecution, with English government tied up in the autumn of 1641. The Protestants seized the opportunity for a preemptive strike. But Ulster's dispossessed Catholics rose in rebellion, killing 3,000 Protestants, with nearly as many fleeing to England. Their horror stories, dreadful enough, were grotesquely exaggerated by the English press, and an Anglo-Scottish army was dispatched to protect remaining British Protestant planter communities. To pay for this army, Parliament passed an act guaranteeing one-fifth of the landmass of Ireland to those who lent £2 million. Just over 1,000 so-called adventurers raised the full sum. Oliver Cromwell was to make good on these claims. So Cromwell was heading over to Ireland with the understanding that one-fifth of Ireland as a landmass was to be given to these investors. Landlords. Most of the land in County Wexford was taken by Cromwell and given to some of his soldiers and followers. Some of these held on to the land they got and married, and it fell to their children. Others sold it later on. It is told of Castleborough that a soldier who had got the deeds of the farm, getting tired from walking, met a man named Carew, and he gave him the deeds and rights to Castleborough for a horse and some money to take him back to Cromwell's army. The Roscarland estate was given to the Lee family by Cromwell, who told Lee someplace near Wellington Bridge that he would give him the land at each side of the road as far as his horse would carry him. The horse, without stopping, dropped dead near Ballinabola. And so Lee became landlord all over that land. Some of the former Lees evicted all the tenants around his own home and levelled out the ditches and houses until he had a farm of 2,000 acres. The people who were evicted went to other countries. Very few planters settled around here. Mr. Lee was a bad landlord and was known as Leveller Lee. It is not the custom to divide farms amongst families in the County Wexford. The landlord used to make his tenants vote for whoever he wished under threat of eviction. If they refused, he sent his man and sowed grass seed in their land and then evicted them. Some people paid tithes. Tenants near Protestant churches had to pay some money for the upkeep of the clergy. There were no battles fought around here, but people resented paying tithes and only paid under compulsion. The landlord of this district was Mr. Lee of Rose Garland. The family had been resident in the district since the time of Cromwell. Mr. Lee was well known for his terrible temper and for the cruelty he inflicted onto his tenants. Five of Lee's tenants in Ballylannan could not pay the rent on time and they were thrown out of their houses. One time, he evicted all the small farmers who lived near his house for no reason, and he leveled the houses and made the farms into a huge field. This field has not been divided since, and it can still be seen. The children and grandchildren of the evicted people are now back in a different part of the land. No one could shoot game on Lee's land, for he held game rights, and if anyone did so, they would be prosecuted. Tithes were collected in this district long ago for the upkeep of the landlord. Bailiffs usually collected the tithes, and for this, people resented their collection, and fights often took place on their account. The people paid the tithes in money, but if they had not enough money, their goods were seized. One day, as Lee was walking out near his farmland, which is a few miles away from his home, he saw some children playing ball on the farmland wall. He was very angry at this, and he dealt the nearest child to him a blow with his whip on their leg. The child's leg swelled up until it was nearly as big as his body, and he could not walk. The other children ran home in terror. Mr. Lee relented almost as quick as his anger had flared out, and he got a doctor later to cure the child. Lee was called Cromwell by his tenants, and his son was called Young Cromwell. Location, Hilltown, County Wexford, that was collected in the class of teacher Simon Murphy. The Ulster Rebellion set alight the fuel which had piled up in an occupied Ireland in October 1641. Ireland would now become chiefly the theatre of the War of the Three Kingdoms between Ireland, England and Scotland for the next 7 years. Warfare throughout Ireland was sporadic, but vicious. The diary of an anonymous English soldier in the winter of 1641 to 1642 includes sickening detail of how he and his fellows shot or hanged civilians and looted and burned the villages that they passed through. One British historian says the diary displayed the casual cruelty of an SS officer on the Russian front in 1942. This violence can be matched by confessed activities of the same kind on the other side of the native Irish, although Murrell admits the worst atrocities were perpetrated by the English on the Irish, and let us not forget, Ireland was being colonised. By the time of Charles I's execution in January 1649, Ireland was more devastated, exhausted, and bitterly divided even than England. With Britain now not under the control of a monarchy, the Royalists had fled to Ireland and were in an uneasy alliance with the Catholic Confederate group, a group they were once fighting. An army loyal to the Long Parliament and Cromwell controlled the Dublin area, but more than 80% of Ireland was in the hands of those hostile to this English revolution, whether it be the native Irish or Protestant Royalists that just wanted to see the return of the crown. It really was a motley crew, and the enemy of my enemy and all that jazz. Cromwell's expeditionary force was intended to reverse this situation by incorporating Ireland into the English Commonwealth, placing it firmly under the direct rule from England, and it was also to carve up enough land to pay up the cost of the conquest and reward English speculators and demobbed soldiers and all those people that had paid up to £2 million. Cromwell's Bell. It is supposed that Cromwell blew the bell out of a church near here, and the bell rang from the church through the air until it fell in a field nearby. There is a little wood there now, and if you stand in the place where the bell sank in the ground, it will open up and swallow you. Every student of Irish history knows well what happened at Drogheda, but many of us may not know that Cromwell arrived at Clonmore, Tahir Parish, County Louth, on the day previous to the attack and levelled a beautiful church which stood near the crossroads. Failing to destroy the church bell, Cromwell ordered his men to have it buried. And tradition states that having buried it in the little plantation on the lands of Peter Maguire of Dysart, it still lies buried there and chimes out the commencement of each century. Cromwell made Clonmore his camping ground on that day and slept at the very spot where stands the dwelling house of the late John Dolan. That came from collector Donal Butterley. So Cromwell was only actually in Ireland from the 15th of August 1649 to the 26th of May 1650. And in that short time, he accomplished a more complete control of Ireland than had been achieved under any English monarch. This led to the most ruthless process of ethnic cleansing that had ever been seen in Western European history, with the arguable exception of the Norman conquest. In the next 5 years, perhaps three quarters of the land held by predominantly Catholic native Irish people was confiscated, redistributed, and given to Protestant Englishmen. At a stroke, the proportion of the land of Ireland held by the former fell from 3/5 to 1/6. Cromwell spent his time securing control of the east of Ireland from Drogheda, 30 miles north of Dublin, to Cork in the south. When he left, only four major Irish towns remained to be taken: Waterford, Limerick, Athlone, and Galway. His successors, first his son-in-law Henry Ireton, and then Charles Fleetwood, were left with a messy, bloody mopping-up operation. Scarlet Street. Long ago, when Cromwell came to Drogheda, the inhabitants ran up Peter Street. Cromwell's men, however, overtook them and slew many of them. Many of them sought refuge in the church on the top of the hill, St. Peter's Church, but in vain. Cromwell's men followed them and killed every man, woman, and child. He then marched on to Scarlet Street, where he slew so many that the street ran red with blood. From that day to this, the people call this street Scarlet Street. Location: Drogheda, County Loud. Teacher: Sister Magdalene. At the heart of Cromwell's conquest was his storming of Drogheda and Wexford. They came to represent a grisly legend, a scar on the collective consciousness in Ireland. In Drogheda, more than 3,000 were killed. In Wexford, not less than 2,000. They died from artillery bombardment, from gunshots, from sword or dagger thrusts, or purely by bludgeon, hitting them across the head. Most brutally and inhumanely was the killing of Sir Arthur Aston, commander of the Drogheda garrison. Aston was clubbed to death with his own wooden leg. Many, perhaps most, were killed in the hot blood of battle, but the others were killed in cold blood, after they had surrendered or after they'd been captured. Milk. Cromwell landed in Wexford at Magdalen Town, which was at the time the entrance to Wexford. There was a man named Stafford who sold the town to Cromwell. Cromwell knocked down several churches in Wexford. He knocked down St. Patrick's Church in St. Patrick's Square. He knocked down another at Selkscar Abbey. He knocked down others at Kilmacrae and Kildavin, where the blood of the priests he killed is still to be seen under the arch of the Kildavin Church. He killed a lot of people in the Wexford marketplace, namely the Bullring. His soldiers got young Catholic children and put them up on their bayonets. One of the children smiled down at Cromwell and he told his soldiers to stop quickly. Another day, a young girl was coming through the fields at the back of Cromwell's fort, carrying a vessel of milk. One of Cromwell's soldiers stopped her and drank the milk. She went home crying, and on her way home, she met none other than Oliver Cromwell, who asked her what was the cause of her crying, and she told him. He then asked her could she identify that soldier, and she said that she could. Cromwell got all his soldiers out in a line in front of the girl. She picked out the man and Cromwell stabbed him with his bayonet in the stomach, out of which spurted the milk. After this event, Cromwell told his soldiers that this was a warning that none of his soldiers could do anything without his permission. That milky story comes from collector George Murphy, address Wexford, County Wexford, from informant Mr. Patrick Davis. The principal evidence against Cromwell comes from his own reports during the time, sent to the Speaker of the English Parliament. They are the words of a general insensitive to the suffering of the Irish people, conditioned by the relentless propaganda of the last 10 years into believing that Irish Catholics were collectively responsible for the torture and killing of 1,000 unarmed Protestant settlers. He convinced himself that this was a righteous religious force. Cromwell was not a radical who wished purely for there to be no monarch in England. Don't give him that credit. He was fighting not for politics, but for his faith. It appears, much like his epiphany during his period of depression, that Cromwell felt like an agent of God, and likely spoke with the confidence of one. It is said that Cromwell had a firm and frightening belief in providentialism, a belief that God was actively directing the affairs of the world through the actions of chosen people, whom God had provided for such a purpose. So Cromwell obviously considered himself chosen by God. So Cromwell's strength was that he knew how to discipline a pious cavalry. He knew how to lead and train his men using moral authority, and seemed he had the assuredness of someone who felt that God was truly on their side. He thought he was doing the right thing and that God was working through them. He heavily relied on biblical imagery and sought meaning and messages from Bible passages to validate his decisions, including Psalm 17 and 105. They that are implacable and will not leave trouble in the land may be speedily destroyed out of the land. And Isaiah 8, in which kingdoms fall and only the godly survive. For Cromwell, the army was God's chosen instrument. Cromwell believed himself, as it seems, to be the divinely ordained instrument of God's retribution. He wrote this of Drogheda. In the heat of action, I forbade them to spare any that were in arms in the town. And I think that night they put to the sword about 2,000 men. Divers of the officers and soldiers being fled over the bridge into the other part of the town, where about 1,000 of them possessed St. Peter's steeple and two other towers. I ordered the steeple of St. Peter's to be fired, where one of them was heard to say in the midst of the flames, God damn me, God confound me, I burn, I burn. The next day the other two towers were summoned. When they submitted, their officers were knocked on the head, and every tenth man of the soldiers killed, and the others shipped as slaves to Barbados. The last Lord's Day before the storm, the Protestants were thrust out of the great church called St. Peter's, and they had a public mass there. And in this very place, near 1,000 Catholics were put to the sword, fleeing thither for safety. I believe all the friars were knocked promiscuously on the head but two, the one of which was Father Peter Tafe, whom the soldiers took and made an end of. The other was taken into the Round Tower under the repute of a lieutenant, and when he understood that the officers in the tower had no quarter, he confessed that he was indeed a friar, but that did not save him. So all of those thought to be soldiers, priests, and Franciscan friars were quickly executed. In addition, there was the burning alive of those who took refuge in the tower of St. Peter's Church. Rather than starve or buy them out with a promise of quarter, Cromwell's men piled the wooden pews of the church under the tower and set the church ablaze. Cromwell's crusade of Ireland was effective, and it was effective precisely because of its inhumanity. Cromwell's reference to the 1,000 killed in or near St. Peter's Church is difficult to square with the military accounts, and significant numbers of civilians must have been included in that figure. A week later, Cromwell wrote that he was sending a list of the officers, and he named nearly 100, and notes the numbers killed beyond that were 220 cavalrymen, 2,500 foot soldiers, besides staff officers, surgeons, and the town's many inhabitants. Cromwell knew that a large part of the garrison and all its senior officers were English Catholics, and that the rest were drawn from Ormond's regiments, whose first duty in the 1640s had actually been to fight against Irish rebels. The following quotation therefore represents Cromwell's attribution of racial guilt to all the Irish for the slaughters of 1641, or a judgment on the civilian casualties to whom he wrongly but plausibly believed had been caught up in that Ulster rebellion and massacre in 1641-1642. I am persuaded that this is a righteous judgment of God upon these barbarous wretches, who have imbrued their hands in so much innocent blood, and that it will tend to prevent the effusion of blood for the future, which are the satisfactory grounds for such actions, which otherwise cannot but work remorse and regret. His report on the slaughter at Wexford to the Speaker is even more graphic. We intended better to this place than so great a ruin, hoping the town might be of more use to you and your army. Yet God would not have it so, but by all unexpected providence, in his righteous justice, brought a just judgment upon them, calling them to become a prey to the soldier, who ill their piracies had made prey so many families, and made with their bloods to answer the cruelties which they had exercised on the lives of poor Protestants. The soldiers got a very good booty in this place, However, I could have wished for their own good and the good of the garrison that they had been more moderate. Cromwell is also not ambiguous to the fact that the atrocity will be followed up by an ethnic cleansing. Quote, "The town is so now in your power that of the former inhabitants, I believe scarce 1 in 20 can challenge any property in their houses. Most of them are run away, and many of them were killed in the service. And it may be wished that an honest people would come and plant here, where there are very good houses and other accommodations to be fitted to their hands." By August 1652, the reduction of Ireland had been effectively completed. To all intents and purposes, Ireland was at the mercy of the British state. In that month, Parliament passed the Act of Settlement, proclaiming that it was not their intention to extirpate the whole nation, but to pardon all husbandsmen, ploughmen, labourers, artificers, and other of the inferior sort, and to punish those of higher rank according to their respective demerits. But great swathes of people, at least 100,000, were exempted from pardon of life and estate. So those of the quoted inferior sort were said to be banished, and those higher born, all their estates and property, they were only allowed to have land equivalent to 1/3 of the value of their current estates in such place in Ireland as Parliament would decide, so they were shunted off to Connacht or County Clare. There was also a punishment of death for anyone that was found within a mile of the coast or of the River Shannon. All clergy and friars are banned from Ireland on punishment of death or enslavement. In 3 of the 4 provinces of Ireland, Ulster, Leinster and Munster, there weren't to be any Catholics at all. This was an ethnic cleansing of huge scale, but deciding who was to be punished proved beyond the resources of the English state. So rather than the 100,000 quoted, probably only 200 people were executed under the Act. But 200 people executed under the legislative tyranny of the English state on grounds purely of religion. So the big case against Cromwell, if you take it from a completely sort of neutral standing, and even forget about the fact that England should have never been in Ireland in the first place, it was that he behaved radically different in Ireland than anywhere else that he behaved in Britain. In any of the wars in England or in Scotland, there wasn't anything nearly on the scale of the massacres that occurred in Drogheda and Wexford particularly. The death rate in these military engagements in England were usually between 5 and 10%, but at Drogheda and Wexford it was almost 80%. By Cromwell's own admission, these included non-combatants, so citizens of the town, and in the knowledge that these people weren't militants. There is detailed testimony from royalist sources that several Protestant officers surrendered on quarter and subsequently were killed, and there is some credible Catholic testimony from Wexford of atrocities against civilians after the town had been secured. So Cromwell and his forces were murdering civilians after they knew that the town had been captured. And since Merle is taking a very solicitor-like, court-like, unemotional, fact-based approach to Cromwell's time in Ireland, these are just of the accounts that one can verify. Catholic Bishop Nicholas French, who was near the town, gave a vivid account of scourgings, tortures and hangings of unarmed civilian priests and friars. Cromwell had undertook this mission knowing full well what the outcome would be. And there was always this assumption that the best of the land would be carved up and given back to those who had invested in the tyranny. Mud Cabin. Long ago, when Oliver Cromwell was robbing and killing in Ireland, he was riding one day into Arklow. He met a man on the road and asked him his name. "My name is Oliver Kearney," said the man. "Well," said Cromwell, "you're the first man of my own name I met since I came to this country. Go out to the rock and climb on top of it, and all the land you see from there I will give you." "I want nothing from you but my own little house," said the man. "A poor man I found you, and a poor man I will leave you," said Cromwell. When all the rest of the town was in flames, a little mud cabin was left standing. It was still there until some years ago, and there was still a family of Kearneys living in it. Collector George Bass, age 14, address Ballinagarry Lower, County Wexford. Informant Mr. Andrew Kinsella, age 66, address Tubberpatrick, County Wicklow. It should be added as well that another key feature of genocide and ethnic cleansing that Oliver Cromwell inflicted onto the population in Ireland between 1650 and 1660 was the destruction of harps and organs. Cromwell was also scorching native Irish culture from the land. Harps were burned and harpers were forbidden to congregate, and harpers and minstrels who had once entertained kings were reduced to travelling from place to place begging for a living where they could. By the end of the 18th century, traditional Irish harpers had become nearly extinct, and it's very likely a lot of traditional Irish music was lost. If you want a little bit more on that, we did an episode called Invention of Music, which deals in all things music and Ireland. Cromwell ordered nobody by any means in military or religious orders to be spared whilst he was in Ireland. Cromwell did in Ireland what was technically in accordance with well-established military codes of practice at the time. It could be suggested that Cromwell was heavy-handed at the beginning of his conquest of Ireland so that when he reached further towns that people would be more likely to surrender knowing how aggressive he had been in some of his first sieges. On the 10th of September 1649, a week after arriving at the town walls, Cromwell summons the governor of Drogheda to surrender within 24 hours. His message was clear: no surrender and no quarter. This idea of no surrender and no quarter was actually in accord with the laws of war at the time. It's also interesting and shocking to note that there was an ordinance of no quarter to the Irish at the time, and this was a decree of the English Long Parliament in response to the Irish Catholic Confederation threats to send troops from Ireland to support King Charles I during the English Civil War. And effectively what this decree meant was that even if you promised people wouldn't be executed after they surrendered, you could go back on those claims as long as they were Irish. In the strictest of terms, Cromwell cannot be called a war criminal. And just in the strictest of terms, under the circumstances that what he did war legal war practices. But barbaric laws do not condone barbarism. You're still a prick under prick laws, you know what I mean? Lord Gormanstown. In the time of Cromwell, the government gave the land to his soldiers and made landlords of them. And then those landlords got rich with every farmer paying his rent to them. It is said Cromwell went to Lord Gormanstown and asked him who he was. He said he was Lord Gormanstown today, whoever he'd be tomorrow. Cromwell said he would be Lord Gormanstown tomorrow because he had tables and food ready for Cromwell's army. Collector Evelyn Butterley. So essentially after those first barbaric sort of unyielding warfare, Cromwell showed restraint, and if people surrendered, he'd go a bit easier on them, even if it is a folk story of Lord Gormanstown. If you bend over, I won't kick you in the arse. Cromwell did write in his diary that the sack of Drogheda would tend to prevent the effusion of blood for the future. I suppose it can be debated what he meant by that. You might read it in a way that he's saying that he's killing future terrorists, for want of a better word, that he killed so many because then they wouldn't rise up again. Or perhaps he meant, as Merle states here, that Drogheda and Wexford were akin to a Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that the application of an economy of evil to save more lives in the long run. This, of course, is a morally contested view. But it is interesting to note that in some of the folk stories there, it's kind of, he's nice to the kids, you know. that soldier stole the girl's milk and he stabbed that soldier. So I don't know. Maybe that's the thing. Cromwell was probably a crazy religious nut, but maybe a crazy religious nut that stood in his weird warped morals. After Cromwell left Ireland, it didn't get much better. There were several more atrocities after his departure. General Fleetwood introduced a policy of reprisal which pre-echoes Nazi cruelty. If an English soldier was killed by snipers or bandits, then the nearest community was given 24 to 48 hours to hand over those responsible for summary execution, or they would all be seized and transported into slavery. So, Jesus, if you were living in a town and an English soldier got killed beside your town, you better rat, or you better know who to rat on, or else you're heading off to Barbados. Not in a fun way, but anyhow. The whole English political and military establishment in Ireland can be blamed for this. Cromwell and the Devil. When Cromwell was in Kilkenny, the Devil told him everything that happened. One day the Catholics were talking of how they would kill Cromwell. The Devil was listening to it. but one of the Catholics that was outside the room saw the devil listening to what they were saying. The Catholic took the sword from his scabbard and threw it at him and drove him out through the window. And ever since, that window has been black. As he was going to the Protestant's house, his footprints remained on the doorstep. It is he, the devil, that told Cromwell everything that the Catholics were going to do. The devil told Cromwell that he was going to be killed. When Cromwell heard this, he put one of his men on his throne and dressed him like himself. The next day, the Catholic went to the tower and he saw a man like Cromwell. He took his sword again and threw it at him, and he cut the head right off the man. When the Catholic saw the head, he knew it wasn't Cromwell's. The Catholic did not go away. When Cromwell saw the headless man on his stone chair, he went up to see him. When the Catholic saw Cromwell looking at the man, he threw his sword again, and he killed Cromwell this time. And that is how Oliver Cromwell was killed. Informant Miss Mary Deegan, address New Park, County Kilkenny. So that's an idea there of how hearsay and folk stories, you can't really rely on them. Oliver Cromwell, of course, did eventually die, but it was from some form of malaria and a kidney stone disease. So someone, he wasn't killed in Ireland. He was only here 9 months. He went home. But I did find it funny in my research that he was buried, of course. And when the monarchy was restored, royalists dug him up, his rotting corpse, and hung him. Or hanged him, as it's right to say, which is crazy. Anyway. The lasting effect of Cromwell's tyranny in Ireland is felt. And there are a myriad quotes and instances one could pull from Irish people, politicians and poets. Even the Teflon Taoiseach Bertie Ahern asked for Cromwell's portrait to be taken down before he had a meeting with the British MP Robin Cook. But perhaps most affecting of all is a quote from Englishman Winston Churchill. He himself spent his first few years of childhood in occupied Ireland at the Viceroy's residence, now Áras an Uachtaráin, is marred by criticism surrounding his callous reaction to the Bengal famine in 1943. And despite the Churchillian notion which supported colonialism and an imperial race predestined by moral character to rule and refashion the world in a British image, it is poignant that even he had this to say in 1957 of Cromwell's conquest of Ireland. Cromwell's record was a lasting bane. By an uncompleted process of terror, by an iniquitous land settlement, by the virtual proscription of the Catholic religion, by the bloody deeds already described, he cut new gulfs between the nations and the creeds. Hell or Connacht were in the terms he thrust upon the native inhabitants. And they, for their part, across 300 years, have used as their keenest expression of hatred the curse of Cromwell on you. Upon all of us, there still lies the curse of Cromwell. Churchill, 1957. I mentioned at the start of the podcast G.K. Chesterton's remark on Cromwell's genocide, that the Irish can never forget it and the English can never remember it. And perhaps this is the flaw baked into many stalwart colonial and Western attitudes. For one to forgive and forget, there must be evidence of a changed behaviour. And whilst Ireland's government shies away from criticism of colonial oppression, Britain, America and other colonial powers still centuries on aids, abets and benefits from them. And we as a nation, at least on a governmental level, are siding with them. The displacement of a people for a new settler colonial habitation. Much of what you see on the news today could read like a history book, or vice versa. And some people confusingly take Ireland's position as subjects of ethnic discrimination in the past as a hall pass for political silence, as if our ancestors' punishment absolves us from rather than inspires us to assist others presently facing the same moral crimes and injustices. It would be ignorant of us to assume that baked into our DNA is not only that of the displaced Irish, but the settlers of Cromwellian and other such plantations. And we have to choose which footsteps to follow in into the future. Our goal shouldn't be to join or cower to the colonial ranks, but to defy them. It should be as easy for us to understand the resistance movements in other countries as it is for us to understand the resistance during the Ulster Rebellion, or indeed the resistance of the rebellion which led to the country that we're currently living in.
song of peace and love.
Oh, whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day.
Of a land that rules all lands above.
Oh, whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day.
May peace and plenty be her share.
The winners write the history, and the losers write the songs.
England is our prayer. Oh, whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day. Oh, whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day. So we say, hip hooray, come and listen while we pray. Whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day.
When we were savage, fierce and wild.
Whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day.
She came like a mother to her only child.
Oh, whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day.
Who took us from primeval slime? Who kept our hands from wanton crime? Who sent us to heaven in our own good time?
Oh, whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day. Whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day. So we say, hip hooray, come and listen while we pray. Whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day.
Our fathers oft were naughty boys.
Whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day.
Guns and pikes a dangerous tie.
Oh, whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day.
From the GPO to Boland's Mill, we made Mother England weep or fill. But old Mother England loves us still.
Oh, whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day. Whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day. So we say, hip hooray, come and listen while we pray. Whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day.
Oh, Irishmen, forget the past.
Yeah, yeah. Whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day.
And think of the time that's coming for us.
Whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day.
Oh, when we'll all be civilized, neat and clean and well advised. Oh, won't Mother England be surprised.
Whack for the diddle, for the di-do-day.
And if I need to spell it out, free Palestine. From the river to the sea.